You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
I would say I have four very close friends, half a dozen pretty close friends.
Somewhere between 6 and 10 real friends.
I'd say that I'm constantly in touch with around 10 friends.
1, 2, 3, 4. I'd say about 5, 6.
1.7. It's fairly typical for a man.
I would guess about 50.
Real friends or Facebook friends?
I know someone who has like 3,000 friends on Facebook.
At the moment, I don't have friends. On Facebook, I've got loads of friends, but on the ground, I've got none.
500 Years of Friendship, Episode 1: Gossips and Goodfellows.
Glancing at my own Facebook profile, I see that I currently have 112 friends. That seems like quite a lot to me, but it's below what Facebook say is the average of 140. And I can't help noticing that almost all my Facebook friends have more friends than I do. Several have 400 or 500, three of them have over 1,000. But can someone have 1,000 friends? 1,000 real friends? Professor Robin Dunbar at Oxford University has been pioneering a new approach to friendship. He has studied the evolution and social behaviour of monkeys and apes, including us humans, and his most recent book is called How Many Friends Does One Person Need? His answer has been so influential that the number is now named after him.
Dunbar's number is the limit on the number of true relationships and friendships you can have. So these are meaningful friendships. It's about 150, and it's really determined by the size of the human brain.
And what is the evolutionary theory behind Dunbar's number?
One of the big puzzles in the course of the evolution of the brain, in mammals in particular, is the fact that primates, let's say monkeys and apes, have exceptionally large brains for body size. And it had been proposed probably about 20 years ago, I guess now, that the reason primates have big brains is that they live in very complex social systems, and indeed it turns out to be the case. And the issue here is these very deeply bonded relationships, which are relationships of kind of reciprocity and obligation and trust in many ways, rather than relationships of the moment. In other words, something you would think of in our terms as a real friendship. These are very, very demanding cognitively, and that's why we need big brains.
Both as a human being and as a historian, I'm resistant to the idea that the brain can really constrain things very much. I like to think, perhaps naively, you know, that we human beings can have whatever number of friends we want. We can behave as we like. We can flout gender and social and emotional stereotypes. Am I deluded in thinking that I can be free from my brain?
Yes. I mean, it depends how you define friendship. So if you want to define it in the Facebook sense, which is just press a button and I friend you, then you can have any number. But in reality, that's not how our social world is organised. There really does seem to be a cognitive limit, and that limit varies from individuals to individuals. So where you lie in that range turns out to depend on the size, basically, of your forebrain, the bit of the brain above the eyes.
Well, now that's really worrying. So I have 112 Facebook friends, so that puts me at the low end. So I'd never even thought about this at this moment. This means I've got a relatively small brain, is what you're saying.
I knew that one was coming. I mean, at the end of the day, the question is, are your 112 Facebook friends your entire social world? Because there are probably people that aren't on Facebook that you would actually consider.
I consider that well beyond my entire social world.
Okay.
I made a big effort to make friends with people.
I think we are in trouble here.
Of course, our friendships today are shaped by the long evolutionary past of our brains, but also by our social and cultural history. Robin Dunbar told me that his favourite appearance of Dunbar's number in the historical record is as the average population size of English villages. In the Domesday Book, he says, the average village size was about 150, and in the 18th century, 700 years later, the figure had hardly changed. So I may be less popular than the average Facebook user, but I like the idea that my own social network is about the size of a slightly small 18th century village. That sounds just about manageable. Scientific work like Robin Dunbar's, along with the dramatic new possibilities that the internet has provided for conducting our friendships, are two of the reasons why historians have recently started to get interested in friends and friendship. The subject is so new that so far there's only one book attempting a comprehensive history of friendship in the West. Its editor is Professor Barbara Kane of the University of Sydney.
I think that it's a fashionable subject at the moment because of changing patterns in how we live. In the West in particular, people marry later or enter into domestic and sexual relationships later or not at all, live in different kinds of ways. Far more people live alone. People live further away from their families. I think in all of those kinds of circumstances, people have become more and more aware that it's friends and groups of friends that make the sort of fundamental networks in which they live. And I think there's also been, probably over the 20th century really, a much stronger interest in the underlying emotional issues that are involved in friendship. What kinds of emotional ties there are, what sorts of overtones there are, what tensions there are, what stresses there are. So I think in that sense it's become sort of foregrounded in our lives rather than being backgrounded.
One great difference between networks of friends now and 500 years ago is that today it's normal to keep in touch with people who live hundreds or thousands of miles away using modern technology. I myself have online conversations with friends in America, Australia, and Japan. Our story starts in Britain in the 16th century. At that time, most people's social networks reached little more than a few miles and were mainly made up of family members and close neighbours. Professor Bernard Kapp is the author of a book about women, family and neighbourhood in this period called When Gossips Meet. He's painstakingly sifted through legal records and other sources to reconstruct everyday friendships 500 years ago. It's especially hard to find evidence of these kinds of relationship in an age before mass literacy. And that's what makes Bernard Kapp's research so remarkable and the examples he finds so valuable. Like this one.
Mary Freeman was married to a London barber in the middle of Queen Elizabeth's reign, and the couple fell out in a rather big way. Her husband, John, contracted the pox, syphilis, and denounced her as the cause of his syphilis, and had her dragged before the London Bridewell Court, which dealt with prostitution, vagrancy, and things of that sort. But Mary was able to produce over 20 neighbours and women who she had kept in childbed, and they testified on her behalf that she was a good, honest person and would not be guilty of any such thing. And interestingly, their support turned the case around, and it was then John who was seen as the guilty party by the court, and he was bound over to be of good behaviour, and she was cleared.
So would you define this as a sort of network of friends, something like a modern social network that she was able to call on for support?
I think this was a network. Some of these people were neighbours, but others were clearly people who had heard about her as a good nurse and had got to know her in that capacity, and then perhaps had moved on to a sort of friendship. They're willing to come and give her practical help. But it has a sort of functional origin and dimension to it.
I know another important category in this period is the gossip. And I'd like to ask, what did that word mean at the time? We obviously have that word today, but I think the word gossip in the 16th or 17th century had a different range of meanings.
Gossip technically meant simply a godparent, a godfather, a godmother who had officiated in that role at a child's baptism. But in the case of women, and only women really, it became a common term for women to use in connection with female friends, women friends, even as a term of address. So you might find a woman saying, you know, well-met gossip or good morrow gossip. And in that sense, it meant women who were friends, often, usually in fact, friends and neighbours, people they would meet and chat with, socialise with, would meet perhaps every day at the well or the bakehouse, and women who would be able to be called upon to lend or to borrow or for advice and practical help when family members, small children, fell sick. So it's a mixture of companionship and good neighbourliness, practical good neighbourliness.
There's another word that I think is an early modern one. Would the equivalent of the gossip for women be the good fellow when we're thinking about men in this period?
Good fellow has a similar sense of a male friend, a man's male friends. It also has the connotation of plebeian level of society primarily. And it's mainly used in the context of a good companion, a boon companion in the alehouse or the tavern. A good fellow is someone you go and share drinks with, spend the evening with, you chat, you drink, you tell jokes, you tell stories, you play games.
Good fellowship could sometimes get out of hand. Two young male friends got so drunk together in 1617 that they pissed into a chamber pot, shared the contents out between their beer glasses and drank it. A ritual of male bonding. Rather them than me, although in my younger days I did witness things that were not entirely dissimilar. For more civilised occasions, then as now, men could seal a bond of friendship by supping from a wine glass, a punch bowl, or a loving cup. And there were songs for such occasions too, such as this one by Henry Purcell.
Would you know how we meet on our jolly full bowls, as we mingle our liquors, we mingle our souls? The sweet melts that up
on our jolly full bowls, as we mingle our liquors, we mingle our souls.
Supportive social networks, women gossiping, men indulging in drinking games, it all sounds pretty familiar. And in a way, it is. In this series, I'll be exploring the similarities between friendship now and in the past. But even when social lives in the past look a lot like ours, we shouldn't assume too quickly that people at the time understood them the same way. Today, we tend to draw pretty clear boundaries between friendship and other kinds of relationship. For instance, with family, work colleagues, or sexual partners. But that wasn't always the case. Professor Naomi Tadmore is a pioneering historian of friendship and the author of a book about friends and family in 18th century England.
The word family meant what we understand today, units of parents, children, other relations and so on and so forth. But people could also speak about their family and actually have in mind household units, including their servants, including boarders and lodgers who are not related but who lived in the household and were part of the family. In the same way, if we think about the meaning of the word friend, originally going back to the Old English, the word meant kin. Friend, Freund, was one's kinsman or kinswoman. So, for example, if a young woman received an offer of marriage, the right and proper thing to do was for her to say, I cannot reply until I consult my friends. And who would those friends be? They would be her parents, perhaps a sibling or an aunt who might be close, perhaps her mistress, perhaps a select friend whose advice was particularly important. In the same way, a young man would have to yield to the advice of his friends and would be able to rely and use his friends. If, for instance, he needed a new place of service or promotion or a loan or surety or anything like that.
Looking again at my own list of what Facebook calls my friends, I see that it includes my wife, my mother, my sister, my nephews and niece, my in-laws and several colleagues. I wouldn't call those people friends exactly, but 500 years ago I would have done, at a time when family, neighbours and friends intermingled in socially complex, if geographically limited, ways. Since then, the meaning of friendship has contracted, but its reach has expanded. Friendship has been shaped not just by our social history, by the habits of men and women working, drinking and talking together in taverns, churches or bakehouses, but by the histories of ideas and technology too. Educated groups of friends who could write letters and exchange printed books, engaging in philosophical discussions right across Europe, had the power to rethink friendship on a much larger scale.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.